Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
It is very alive, I think, in our culture today that there's widespread belief that there really is no such thing as right and wrong. It's a title, the term I'm going to give to it is moral relativism. And it's going to be based upon a distinction between what's in the mind and what's in reality, as I have laid out here. So if there's a tree out there in reality, and then inside your mind, in a sense, there is a tree. Obviously, there isn't literally a tree inside your mind, but there is some likeness, some awareness of the reality that's out there. So you have these two things, what's in the mind and what's in reality, but they don't always correspond. You could have something in the mind, such as a unicorn, that doesn't correspond to anything outside there in reality. So with this idea in mind, between there are things out there in reality that we can know, and then things in our mind that don't correspond in reality, we can get a picture of what moral relativism claims. Moral relativism claims that moral ideas like right and wrong are like the unicorn. They're really just in our minds. They're not in reality. So an example would be, so the unicorn is not out there in the mind. An example would be, so one man kills another man. That's what's going on in reality. The person is aware of it in his mind. So far, so good. Now, moral realism is going to say on the side of reality, and not just on the side of the mind, it really is wrong. And then we can come to know it. So moral realism is going to say that right and wrong are just like the tree. Tree's out there in reality and we come to know it. So too, this is really wrong in reality and we can come to know it. But according to moral relativism, it's just in the mind. It's like the unicorn, right? So just as we make things up in our minds like unicorns, so we make things up in our minds such as there's right and wrong. So right and wrong is merely mental ideas and nothing in reality. Sometimes we express this as saying, well, everybody's got different opinions. There really isn't any right and wrong. Most we might say, oh, what's right for one person is not right for another person, things like that. That might be various ways in common speech that we express these ideas. I'm going to look at another way of expressing this, and this is going to be in terms of being a wrongdoer. So, again, we have a man shoots somebody, but in this case, he thinks, so this is the guy himself is doing the shooter, and he thinks that he's shooting a bear. Okay. So, what's going on in reality, he's shooting another human being. In his mind, he thinks that he's shooting a bear, hallucinating for some reason. We'll say it's not his fault. He's been brainwashed or something like that, right? In the end, we wouldn't blame him for killing the bear. And the distinction I want to make is to say that it's wrong out there in reality, but in his mind, what he's doing is not wrong, right? So this bear is attacking him. So he thinks, and so he is protecting himself, right? So, is he a wrongdoer? Is he somebody who does something wrong? Well, in reality, on the side of reality, he's doing something wrong. He's killing another human being. On the part of his mind, he's not doing something wrong. And the terminology, the terminology we use for that oftentimes is objectively, means on the part of reality, and subjectively means on the part of the mind. So objectively, we might say, well, he's doing something wrong. Subjectively, he's not doing anything wrong, right? Now, in terms of moral realism and moral relativism, then we can say that moral terms such as right and wrong refer to something real in human actions, and so ultimately we can be objectively wrong and also subjectively wrong. You can be both. Whereas for moral relativism, moral terms such as right and wrong refer to nothing real in reality. They're only in our minds. So all that we could ever say about somebody is that they're subjectively doing something wrong, and we could never say of anybody that they are objectively doing anything wrong. So that's laying out sort of the terms, moral relativism and moral realism. We're looking at moral relativism, trying to see if it makes any sense. And the most common argument that's given for moral relativism is called the argument from disagreement. So even people on the street will give this argument quite regularly. It's such a common argument in favor of this. It begins by saying that societies disagree about moral questions. So typical examples that are used are monogamy and polygamy. Say, for instance, some societies are monogamous, other societies are polygamous. Cannibalism is another example that's oftentimes used, where some societies say that it's wrong to eat other human beings, and some societies practice it on a regular basis. Another example that sometimes comes up is the practice of suti, which in certain northern Indian states was a practice that if a man died, then they would burn his wife at the funeral with the husband. They're both burned. So she was cremated alive, though, and he was cremated dead. So this practice called suti, and it comes up in moral relativist discussions because the British, of course, were ruling over India for over 100 years. And so the British came in, and they were horrified, and they put a end to this practice of suti. So the British are saying this is wrong, but these northern Indian territories were saying that this is okay. So state that there is moral disagreement. And so then the second step, which is something of a leap, says, so there really must be no reality to the matters. That's basically how the argument is presented. Point out disagreement. Once you point out disagreement, you say there is no reality to the matter. Well, how do we reply to this? Well, it's important to distinguish between three different questions that we might ask. Three questions are, first of all, is there disagreement? That was the first step of the argument from disagreement, was answering that question. Yes, there is disagreement. Polygamous societies, monogamous societies, cannibalists, and so on. So that first step is answering this question, is there moral disagreement? The second question that we can ask, is there one truth or one reality? And that's what the conclusion of the argument from disagreement is trying to say, that there is no one truth or one reality involved, right? So that's the second question. There's a third question that will become important as we go along. Can we prove it? Okay. So suppose someone says there is a truth or reality. Well, can we prove what that truth or reality is? The problem with this is that these are three quite distinct questions, but we oftentimes confuse them. We think by answering one somehow or whether answering another one. And in fact, that's what I think the argument from disagreement is doing here. So the key to arguing against the argument from disagreement is that disagreement, answering the first question, is there disagreement, tells us nothing about the world. That is, it tells us nothing about the second question, is there one truth or one reality, right? And we recognize this quite readily in other areas outside of moral questions. So a very common example is the flat earth, okay? So is there disagreement about the shape of the earth? Well, a lot of times when you ask people that, they say, well, yeah, before Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 or something like that, which is a bunch of historical bunk, as it turns out, since people knew that the earth was round for millennia before Columbus ever sailed the ocean blue. The disagreement at the time of Columbus was not whether the earth was round. Everybody knew it was. I mean, everybody in Europe knew it was, at any rate. disagreement was how big is it, right? So he went to Portugal and he said, I can sail off into the west and I can reach China. And the Portuguese actually were the sailing nation at the time, not the Spanish. And they said, you're nuts. You're going to starve to death before you ever get there because the world is too big. They actually had a very accurate perception of how big the world was, and Columbus thought it was a lot smaller. So he thought, well, yeah, he could, you know, store enough food on the little ships they had to make it all the way across to China. He was lucky, of course. He didn't have to go all the way to China. And so, in the end, when he went to the Spanish, it paid off. But it wasn't because he knew what he was talking about. But everybody knew that the world was round. But still, there is disagreement that, as a matter of fact, there has been, certainly. Arguments for the earth being round go back, you know, at least to Aristotle, which is, you know, 300s before Christ. And, but certainly around that time, say, if you talk to the people in Germany, they might well think that the earth was flat, right? So there was disagreement then. And I think, well, there's no disagreement now. Well, there it is, the Flat Earth Society. So you may chuckle at the Flat Earth Society. No, actually, they've got a kind of up-to-date website. For a while there, they didn't. It was too advanced for them in some way or other. But talk a little bit more about the Flat Earth Society. But so there are people who will say that the Earth is flat, but one way or the other, whatever they happen to believe, there's one truth, one reality. Somebody who believes the Earth is flat is not going to sail off and fall off the edge of the Earth, right? So, because there is no edge of the Earth. So the fact that people disagree about the shape of the Earth doesn't change the one reality that is out there. The one reality is the same one way or the other. So we don't make this move, oh, there's disagreement, therefore there's no truth in the matter. Nobody would make that move about the shape of the Earth. But for some reason, when it comes to morals, we say, oh, yeah, well, people disagree about monogamy and polygamy. Oh, there must be no truth to the matter. Well, it doesn't work for the shape of the Earth, and it doesn't work for morals, right? Another area where we find disagreement is discussions about evolution. This is a lot more heated disagreement, maybe, than the shape of the Earth. You will find people disagreeing about whether evolution took place or how it took place and so on. So there's widespread disagreement. Does that mean there's not one truth to the matter? Well, I'm not going to try and settle the truth to the matter, but there is one truth to the matter, right? Whatever it may be that human beings evolved from ape-like creatures. It may not be that human beings evolved from ape-like creatures, but it is the same reality for everyone involved. So there can be one reality out there, even if we don't know necessarily what it is in that case. So when we look at these examples, we see that what does disagreement tell us about? It doesn't tell us about the world. It doesn't tell us that the Earth, there is no shape to the Earth. It tells us about ourselves. Reality tells us something about ourselves. It tells us that our minds are limited, right? So we have a tough time understanding the truth oftentimes. Any flat earthers out here in this group?
No, this is about you, said. He's the president of the society.
I ask because you might think the Earth is round, but can you give arguments for it, right? Can you give arguments for it? If you go to the Flat Earth Society website, you'll actually see some pretty challenging arguments. The Flat Earth Society started maybe about 150 years ago. And it started because there was an experiment done in England in a canal over a, you know, basically flat terrain. And so they knew the canal was not going up or down hills or anything like that. So they put one person at one end, and at the other hand, they had a post or flag that they put. And if the Earth was round, they shouldn't have been able to see over it, right? They shouldn't have been able to see over the curvature of the Earth, right? It's like if you're on one side of a hill and the flag is on the other side of the hill, you're not going to be able to see it, right? It's only if it's flat between you and the flag are you going to be able to see it. And it was a big enough distance that, you know, you shouldn't have been able to see it, but you'd stand there and you could see the flag, right? So looks like pretty good argument that this is flat. You're dealing with water where you can see that, you know, it's flat the whole while through, right? If it's not flat, it's because it's following the shape of the Earth. Water would follow the shape of the Earth, so it should be curved, and therefore you shouldn't be able to see the flag. Well, it turns out you need some pretty high-powered physics to to explain what happens, right? It has to do with refraction of light and things like this. So most of us could not, in fact, explain what's going on in that experiment, right? So we have limited minds, right? So there are arguments that the Earth is round or that are flat that we might not be able to answer ourselves. And we may not be able to really understand the arguments with regard to evolution either. So our minds are pretty limited, and that's one of the reasons that we end up with disagreement. It's not because there's no truth to the matter, it's because our minds are limited. Another reason why we end up with disagreements is that our desires confuse us. And this is a matter of coming up with what I will call rationalizations. So what is a rationalization? Well, I know Kevin and Jason, so I'll have to pick on them, I guess. So suppose that Jason got up from his seat and left a $100 bill sitting there. And Kevin sees the $100 bill and he thinks, oh, I should better return that to Jason. But then he starts thinking, man, I've had some tough breaks lately. $100 would sure be nice. And, well, pretty soon he's telling himself, like, well, you know, finders keepers, losers weepers. And at the end of it all, Jason never sees his $100 bill again, okay? So this is what I'll call a rationalization. Kevin is engaging in a rationalization which has three steps. He begins by knowing what is right and wrong. He begins knowing I should return that $100 bill, right? But the second step is that he desires what is wrong. He wants to take the $100, right? So you need that step involved. And the third step is most properly the rationalization that you tell yourself a story to feel better about doing what is wrong. So finders, keepers, losers, weepers, or, you know, Jason isn't going to miss it. He's got money falling out of his pockets, whatever it might be, you know. So we tell ourselves this story. So this can lead to disagreement within society because whole societies can rationalize, right? We rationalize our actions to others, and so too societies can rationalize their practices. So something like slavery, for instance, in the antebellum South, there were lots of arguments in favor of slavery. The slaves were incompetent, unable to take care of themselves, for instance, and so it was for their own good that we are practicing slavery. Or the economy needs slavery too much. If we ended it, it would be a disaster for everybody, the slaves, you know, as well as the slave owners. So you get these arguments that plausibly are rationalizations, right? The slave owners want to keep their slaves, and so they're going to come up with arguments for it, right? Because there's disagreement, we want to say that there's no truth to the matter, that there isn't anything really right and wrong about slavery. No. What we can say is we have limited minds, and our desires sometimes mislead us and lead us to rationalizations. The second argument, so that's the first argument, the argument from disagreements, again, is by far the most common argument for moral relativism. The second argument is I'm sorry. First of all, I have a second reply to the argument from disagreement. So the first step of the argument, so the first reply really question making a move from the first step to the first second. So first step, there is disagreement, move to the second step, then there's no right and wrong. My reply was saying, yeah, there's disagreement, but that doesn't tell us anything about whether it's right and wrong. It tells us about ourselves. Our minds are limited. Our desires mislead us. There's a second reply that asks, well, what about that first step? Is there really any disagreement between cultures? And of course there is, as we've already pointed out. But as it turns out, much disagreement ends up being disagreement over what we will call matters of fact. Don't particularly like the terminology, but it's out there. So the difference here is between facts and values. So facts are the way the world is, and values express our attitudes towards the world. So the way the world is I'm standing and you're sitting, for instance, right? Those would be things about facts that we could say about the world. Values, according to this notion of values, not a definition of values I'm endorsing, but this is what these people will, who make this distinction will say, express our attitudes towards the world, right? So given this distinction, then we can sort of turn it back on the moral relativists and point out that much disagreement is not over matters of moral principles. There's actually much agreement over moral principles, but there's disagreement over facts in the situation. Probably the most common example that comes up with regard to this is the treatment of cows, and this again brings in India. So in certain parts of India, cows are considered sacred animals, and that they should not be killed and they should not be eaten. Most of the world has thought that cows are animals that we can kill and use for food and for leather and things like this. So you have disagreements over how to treat cows. And it seems like it's a moral disagreement. But it turns out that between these Hindu-Indian societies and the rest of the world, there is actually a fair amount of moral agreement. Right? The moral agreement is that we should treat those with a rational soul with a certain respect, including the idea of not killing them, certainly not killing the innocent. The disagreement is over a question of fact. Who is or a rational being? Does a cow have a rational soul, right? So these Hindu societies believe that the cows are elevated, reincarnated souls, right? And so that's why they think they are sacred animals. Those that think we can kill cows think, well, no, they don't have rational soul. So what's the disagreement here? It's not over the moral principle about how to treat those with a rational soul. It's a disagreement about what a cow is, and that's a disagreement over matters of fact, not over moral questions. Even something like cannibalism, one finds that societies that practice cannibalism, and there are kind of two kinds of cannibalism, I shouldn't make note. So there are some cannibalist societies who have ritualistic cannibalism of eating small portions of the dead, right? So, and I'm not concerned with those. The more popular notion we have of cannibalism is one tribe hunting down another tribe and eating them, which seems to be have been the more common, perhaps, in human history. And that's the one I'm really looking at, because what you find there is the disagreement over matters of fact, namely, who is or who is not a human being. So they say, members of our tribe, those are human beings. They'll often refer to those outside their tribe in animal terms, like calling them pigs or something like this. And so there's disagreement there. One even finds, amongst, say, the Nazis, widespread killing in the Holocaust, or the communists under Stalin killing so many people, they would dehumanize their victims. They would say that they're not really human. So they try to, it's as if our minds can't disagree about the moral question. We're more ready to disagree about the question of fact of who is a human being. It's kind of stunning if you think about it. We're more willing to disagree about that than we are to disagree about the moral question. So in the end, there is a kind of fundamental moral agreement. That's what the second reply is saying. The first step of the argument, there is disagreement, moral disagreement. Yes, there is. There's no question that there is, right? But at the same time, there's a kind of fundamental moral agreement that you can find in society. C.S. Lewis pointed this out. He spoke of it as, he called it, the Tao, right? And then if you ask, well, why is there disagreement in morals? And some people say, well, you find more disagreement in morals. Well, if so, that's not a surprise. Because remember, the second reason why we might disagree is that our desires lead us to disagree. Well, where do our desires come into play? Well, they come into play a lot of times over moral questions, right? So we don't want our desires restrained, right? Kevin doesn't want his desire for money restrained by that pesky moral rule that he shouldn't be taking money from other people, right? So it's because our desires sort of bump into morality that we end up with disagreement in moral questions. Remember the third question I asked, I pointed out. So the first question, is there disagreement? Second question, is there one truth or reality out there? Third question is, can we prove it? And someone might ask, can we prove morals? Somebody might say, okay, maybe the argument from disagreement doesn't really work. But still, it doesn't matter. Because even if there's something right and wrong, we can never know what it is. And a lot of times, people actually use disagreement for this. So it might look like the same argument. The argument from disagreement that we started with said, there's disagreement, so there's no right and wrong. And now they say, oh, look, there's so much disagreement out there, we really can never know what's right and wrong. Is that the same argument? Well, it's kind of close, but it's not the same argument. The conclusion is different. Starting the same place, there's disagreement. The first one said, there's no truth to the matter. The second one's saying, we can't know the truth to the matter, right? So they're subtly different conclusions that are reached. So we have to recall our three questions again. Is there disagreement? Is there one truth or reality? And can we prove it? It's really looking at that third question, can we prove it? It's not questioning the second one, which is what the first argument did. So can we know or prove moral questions? Well, there can be disagreement, although we can prove something. So the argument from disagreement now is saying, oh, there's disagreement, so we can't really know. Well, but disagreement, yeah, at least they're getting something right here, because they're telling us that disagreement tells us something about our minds, right? That first use of disagreement says, oh, there's no reality in the matter. Well, disagreement doesn't tell us anything about reality, but it does tell us something about our minds, okay? So now the argument is improved because it's saying, well, there's disagreement and that tells us something about our minds. We can never know what's right and wrong. That's what it tells us, we say, right? But it turns out that there can be disagreement over matters even though we can prove something. So there can be a proof, but people are not educated in the matter. So there are actually proofs that the earth is round, right? As I say, Aristotle gave proofs going back to, 300s BC. Perhaps the easiest proof is just based upon lunar eclipses in which the shadow of the earth falls upon the moon. And they're pretty common, unlike solar eclipses, which are not so common. So lunar eclipses, you can see several, many in your lifetime if you get a good clear night and you know when it is. And shadow of the Earth is falling across the moon, and what you have to observe is that the shape of that shadow is always circular. Shape of the center is always circular. You might say, well, that just means it's a flat disk. But that doesn't quite work, because a flat disk doesn't always throw a circular shadow. If the light is coming at the disk at an angle, it throws an elliptical shadow, not a circular shadow. So the fact that it's perfectly circular the whole while through indicates that the Earth is, in fact, round. See, there are arguments. You can prove that the Earth is round. But it doesn't mean that everybody knows those arguments, right? Probably most of us here didn't know that argument. And as I say, when we look at the arguments for the flat Earth, we might not know how to reply to those, right? So in that case, we can prove something, yet some people might not know be educated in it, and so they could end up disagreeing because they're not educated in the arguments that the Earth is round. And then secondly, rationalizations might get in the way. Remember when Kevin rationalized, he actually started by saying, oh, I should return that money, right? So it starts by knowing what's right and wrong, but we confuse ourselves, don't we? We confuse ourselves because we want to satisfy our desires. Psychologists talk about cognitive dissonance, where we have a belief in conflict with our desires, and we don't like that tension within ourselves, so we resolve it. In this case, you resolve it by throwing out the belief, right? More ideally, you could throw out the desire, right? But at any rate, we try to resolve it. So we could have a proof and yet disagreement because people rationalize. Again, as I suggested, for slave owning or something like that. Right? All right, so the second argument in favor of moral relativism is called, I've adjusted the name here, the oddity of morals. The name initially given to it in the 1970s was the argument from queerness. Well, queerness has taken on a new meaning since the 1970s, so I have to sort of adjust it to the argument from oddity, right? So the argument from oddity of morals. So the idea here is that moral terms like right and wrong are rather odd. They're different. They're not like things like I'm standing or you're sitting or the sun is shining, or that snow is white, or something like that. That is not the sort of idea that is conveyed by moral terms. They are not, in fact, empirical, the claim is made. All these things are empirical. You can confirm by experience that I'm standing, that you're sitting. You can confirm whether the sun is shining or not. You can confirm the color of snow empirically by experience. Why all these things? Because they are values and not facts. I'm going back earlier, we said values are express our attitude towards the world, right? So in the end, the conclusion is they're this weird sort of thing. They don't seem to be in the world. And so the argument from oddity is saying, I can understand what it means for the sun to be shining as being something real in the world, but what does it mean to say that monogamy is right or that killing is wrong? That's kind of weird. That's kind of odd. It's not the same sort of thing, and it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that you're going to find out there. Well, in response to this, we can recognize that morals are maybe a little bit different. We can agree with that in some way or other, but not because they're not in reality. It's because they are relational terms. So this would be something like fatherhood. So I am the father of my daughter, for instance, right? You could say that's something real, right? It's something real in the world, but it's not something you can kind of point to the way you can point to I'm standing or you're sitting So it's a little harder to get a grasp on. It's a little bit odd. It's a little bit different. And so it's, to some extent, a little bit less empirical, we might say. And the same thing we're going to say about morals, and what we're going to do is look at a thing, an action, and a relation, and a goal in order to try to explain morals. So if the thing is somebody driving to get somewhere or other, they want to get to the grocery store, say, for instance, then to get to the grocery store, they should turn right. And we also use the word right, as in correct, right? Right means right and left-handed, but it also means correct or incorrect, right? So right is the correct directions. We speak that way, and we want to say we're saying something real about the world, right? Even though that's not something we can just point to the way we can point to the sun shining or I'm standing or here or sitting. Nevertheless, it's something real. Turning left, on the other hand, is wrong way to get to the grocery store. And again, that's expressing a kind of relation. So what's going on here? The relation in the terms right and wrong is that the action gets you to the goal, or at least moves you to the goal, and the relation expressed by the word wrong means that it is not getting you to the goal. Right? We could do the same thing if we talked about a doctor who's aiming at healing somebody from having a bacterial infection of the lungs, prescribes an antibiotic, that's the action, and that's the right action because it gets you to the goal of being cured of the bacterial infection. Well, maybe she prescribes an antacid. She's a bad doctor, I guess. Then that's the wrong prescription because it doesn't get to the goal, right? So we can see that outside of morals, we're using these terms right and wrong in a very coherent way. But they are a little bit odd in the sense that they're not quite as straightforward as I'm standing or you're sitting or the snow is white or something like that. But they're real. They're very real. They're expressing a relation between an action and a goal. So if we had a human being and we just said the human or the moral goal, not specifying much more beyond that, and we had an action like helping the needy, if we say it's right, that means it's getting you to the human or the moral goal. If you say an action like murder is wrong, that means it's not getting you to the moral goal. In this case, this last case of a human being, it's less clear. You might say starting the first one is the clearest. This is a little bit less clear exactly. You know, we understand getting to places a lot easier than understanding getting to health, right? So, and here we've got two difficulties. We have difficulty understanding what gets us to the goal, but we also, a lot of times, have difficulty identifying what the goal is, right? So I just put the human or the moral goal, but a lot of times we struggle identifying that. So these are less clear, but it's not because they mean something so unusual they have nothing to do with reality. It's because it's a little more difficult, going back to our minds are limited. Dealing with difficult things and identifying the goal, you're dealing with difficult things and identifying how what actions get us there and what actions do not. So that brings us to moral realism. We note that we know the good in other areas outside of morals. We can speak about what is the good of a knife. A good knife cuts well. A good knife is sharp. We would speak that way. And we would all nod our heads and say, of course, that's what a good knife is. If you say, well, what's this weird or odd thing called the goodness of the knife? We wouldn't say, well, no, it's nothing real about the knife. Yeah, it really is a good knife because it's sharp, right? So too, we can identify what a good doctor is. A good doctor heals well. We all want to get a good doctor. And so if somebody's told us there really isn't a difference between good or bad, because that's just weird sort of stuff out there, we'd say, well, I don't know. I still want to make sure I get a good doctor, right? We do think there's something truly good or truly bad about various doctors. What's going on here is that in all of these cases, we have something that's moving to an endpoint, and the good is the completion of that. The picture would be of an arrow going to hit a target, right? So there you've got a pretty clear picture of something going towards an endpoint. And you could talk about a good shot or a bad shot based upon whether it's going towards that target or not going towards that target, right? And that's in general what's involved here. So we could speak about a good doctor or a bad doctor. Why? Because the doctor is heading towards an endpoint. What's that endpoint? Health, right? So a good doctor is going to get you to the goal. Bad doctor is not. Same thing with a knife. It's heading towards an endpoint of cutting things, right? Very simple endpoint of cutting things. And so a good knife is going to get to the endpoint. So the good is the completion of the thing, right? So the good of the knife is that it actually cuts well. The good of the doctor is that it actually heals well. Now, it's not just any completion, because it has to be the completion of something heading towards an endpoint. And the example I have here is of a triangle. This triangle is complete because it has all three sides. In fact, if you have an incomplete triangle, you just don't have a triangle, right? So if it only had two sides, it wouldn't be a triangle, right? So a triangle is always complete. But it is complete, but we don't talk about it being the triangle or a bad triangle or anything like that. Why? Because triangles aren't heading to an endpoint, right? We talk about something as good or bad when it's heading towards an endpoint, right? So the idea here is the thing is in some way stretching beyond itself. Again, the arrow is moving towards the target, that's most straightforward, but the doctor is moving towards health, the knife is moving towards cutting. Triangle's not moving anywhere, so that's why it doesn't have any goodness attached to its completion. So we can speak about things being good insofar as they have parts that are ordered to that end. So the knife has a sharp edge, that part's ordered to the end. In the end, we can see that there are three different meanings of the word good. The completion, which I've just been talking about, the completion of being sharp, of cutting well, or of healing well. But also the subject that is completed, the good knife, or the good doctor. So on the one hand, being sharp is good for a knife. On the other hand, a sharp knife is a good knife, right? So obviously related ideas of good, but not the exact same meaning. And then the third is something that produces this sort of completion. This is a useful good. So you might say a knife sharpener is good for a knife. Okay, a knife sharpener is good for a knife. Why? Because it produces the good completion of the knife, the being sharp for the knife, right? All these areas, we speak about what's good, and we don't blink. We don't blink for a moment and say, oh, that's nothing real, right? No, we readily recognize we're talking about reality in these cases. So why, when it comes to human beings, is it suddenly different? We say, oh, right and wrong, oh, that's nothing real about reality. No, that's just in our minds, right? We have to watch out for the idea that there's some kind of special quality of goodness, right? What people in the end start doing when we start talking about good and evil in human affairs, right? In these other areas, there's no special quality. It's just a quality that completes the thing, right? The knife doesn't have some special added quality of goodness. It just has the quality of sharp, being sharp, and that quality completes its movement to an endpoint. So that's all there is. You don't need some kind of special quality of goodness. And we shouldn't expect to find in human beings any special quality of goodness. All we need look for is the completion of a human being. So this is based upon the idea that human beings must have some goal or purpose. I think this is really the center of the matter. This is why the moral relativist says, well, in human matters, yeah, I can talk about a good doctor or a good knife, and I know what I'm talking about. In human matters, no. Why? Because they think human beings are like that triangle, right? The triangle isn't moving anywhere. And I say of human beings, there is no human purpose, there is no human goal. If that's the case, there really is no human good. So when we talk about a human good, we're just making up some special quality the way we make up unicorns or something like that. And it's not anything real that is out there. Ultimately, if human beings have some kind of function, as Aristotle said, that human beings are here to seek the truth, and as Christianity would say, that human beings are here to know and to love God, ultimately implies that human beings are stretching beyond themselves, right? Just as that arrow is going beyond itself to the target, the doctor is going beyond itself to heal, or herself to heal, so too, human beings, we have within us something that's stretching beyond ourselves. Now, in all these other areas, we know what ought means as well, right? So one word is good or bad. Another word is what you ought to do. And so someone might say, well, if you want to get in shape, you ought to exercise, right? Nobody blinks there and says, oh, well, that word ought doesn't mean anything real. No, we know that it means something real. It means that it would be a necessary for the goal, right? A doctor ought to heal. No problem there. A lawnmower ought to cut the grass. If not, it's a bad lawnmower, right? So we use the word ought. Same thing going on here. There is an end point, and then there's some means to achieve it. But to say you ought to do it means that it's a kind of hypothetically necessary to achieve it. In other words, if you're going to attain this end, then you need this means. If you're going to get in shape, you need to exercise, right? So you have some kind of hypothetical necessity. You could say that if you want to fit the shape into the hole, right, you ought to get the right shape matched with the right hole, right? If you ask what's the fastest way to get from London to Paris, well, you might say you ought to get on the channel, right? Rather than take an airplane or take a boat, the fastest way is going to be to go underneath the ocean in the channel. So, You use the term ought there, and again, it's hypothetical. Given the goal of Paris, it's going to be necessary, or getting there fast, it's going to be necessary to take the channel. Why then, in all these other areas, we ordinarily speak this way, why again in morals should we expect it to be any different? The problem is, we suppose, starting with Immanuel Kant, that there is some kind of such a thing called a categorical imperative, which does not depend upon an end point. This is a kind of moral imperative. You ought not steal, and that's just a rule that's out there. As opposed to you ought not steal means, given the end that you have as a human being, stealing's not going to get you to the end, right? That's the meaning that we're suggesting that's going on here. There's no... Just it's the same that we use it in every other area. It's just that there is a human purpose. If you deny there's a human purpose, you've effectively denied that there is morality. So if there is some human end, then the moral ought is simply a hypothetically necessary ought. If you're going to achieve the human end, don't steal, don't murder. If you're going to achieve the human end, then help out the poor, and so on. So it's depending upon the end, not necessarily conscious desire. When we talk about having an end in human affairs, we think, oh, well, I want to get in shape. I have a conscious desire. I want to get in shape. And that's one kind of end we can have. But this is talking about a deeper end that we have here, not just what you happen to desire. This is the end that you are born with, that you are made for, right? That human beings have an end, even apart from any desire that they have. They have effectively a function that we can speak of. Just as the doctor has the function of healing, so human beings have a function, and that's how we know morals. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.